This month, The Spectator becomes the first magazine in history to print 10,000 issues, and we'd like to celebrate with you. Subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a bottle of commemorative Spectator gin, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/celebrate.
Welcome to a rather different edition of the Spectator podcast. I'm Fraser Nelson, editor of the Spectator, and we always think that each issue of the magazine tends to be shared around by about three or four other people. Subscribers quite often give it to their friends and family, and that's going to be a little bit trickier now that we're in lockdown. So we were thinking, how do we get the columns, the articles that people might be missing, that their family might have been passing on to them before? And we came up with the idea of this podcast. So we've asked three of our columnists to read their articles out loud. I'm delighted to say that we've got Matthew Paris, Liner Shriver, and Isabel Hardman. First off is Matthew Paris on why we should not consider this to be a war.
Shut up, don't you know there's a war on? Strong hints of that attitude have emerged in recent weeks, and the hints are getting stronger. The attitude is mistaken. The right answer to any inquiry about whether we know there's a war on is that there isn't a war on. Nobody with sensible questions to ask about the current strategy or its implementation should be abashed to ask them. Hitler's spies are not listening, Lord Haw Haw will not be broadcasting them, and a grown-up citizenry does not confuse intelligent questioning with unpatriotic breaking of the ranks. No doubt some questions will be misplaced, some will have easy answers, and a few may hit home. So courtesy is needed, and we must start from the assumption that everybody is doing their best. But critical scrutiny has seldom been more necessary. Comparisons with the Second World War are preposterous. We face no existential threat as a nation. No fascist dictator is trying to take over the planet. Nobody is trying to exterminate an entire race of people. It's important to remind ourselves that, for instance, ventilators, about which everybody is now talking, are a relatively recent medical advance. And more generally, that our era is keeping alive millions more old people, but in very, very fragile health. With this, inevitably, comes heightened susceptibility. Every death is a personal tragedy, but figures do matter. It worries me that bald media reports of, say, 2,000 deaths so far tend to land on the public imagination as might reports of a terrific train crash, like some kind of awful incident, rather than a shift in the cause of deaths that in many cases were already imminent. My darling mother died last night as I write this. She was 93 and COVID-19 was not allowed to get her, so other things did. Her passing was peaceful, timely and quick, and if I'm able to avoid descending into mawkishness over the death of someone who had been the dearest person in the world to me, then I shall dare risk unsentimentality in observing the passing of others too. We need to get this into proportion. Too much time is now chasing too few new facts. One sympathises with editors and broadcasters, it can't be easy, but we're slipping into a general media response that badly needs calming. Politicians and public health authorities are being invited into studios to make statements, "Have you anything to tell the nation, sir?" rather than answer serious questions. Broadcasters and journalists are filling the air with frightening or moving personal stories which are essentially anecdotal, with little indication of how representative they are. A friend who's a junior doctor in the public health sector answers my texted inquiry with the news that in the general hospital in the large town where she works, there really isn't a problem, or not thus far. I've yet to hear any health professional interviewed whose story is that they are not facing an avalanche. Now, is it that such witnesses do not exist, or is it that they are uninteresting to broadcasters? My doctor friend's other remark, I simply quote her, was that the arrogance of doctors is becoming insufferable and years of uncritical adulation of the NHS now threaten. I heard on the Today programme a specialist in palliative care say, with a catch in her voice, that she was having to confront patients with a choice whether to die at home or in hospital. I should have wished gently to have asked her whether this isn't a question that often has to be asked in palliative care. She might well have been able to explain, but her remark was left to go unchallenged. I heard a doctor lamenting, probably with reason, the shortage of personal protective equipment and explaining that sweaty victims of the virus were touching her hospital blues, yet she had to wear the same blues unchanged for a whole day. But how should she change? After each patient? How often? Again, she may have had a good answer, but nobody asked. Last Sunday on BBC Radio 4, I heard a senior medical officer from Scotland tell her interviewer, or appear to, not only that testing was not available for those without symptoms, but that it couldn't or shouldn't be. What did she mean? I wanted to ask. Are we perhaps into a realm of broadcasting where generalist presenters are simply unequipped to drill down into the answers they receive from experts? An impression arises that all the experts agree, so we laymen needn't bother our heads with details. But I have the distinct impression that beneath an almost priestly air of consensual expertise, real differences seethe. We do ourselves down by putting the experts on a pedestal, calling it the science, and saying we must obey it. We end up wiping away the doubts and debates that inform the actual science. Shouldn't we hear professionals debate each other? Should medical and statistical correspondents perhaps be doing the questioning? Nor is this want of forensic interviewing restricted to medical science. How is it that a line of some £350 billion credit has become available to us when every previous Chancellor has insisted that we're skint? Can every country do this? Is there no limit? It's all very well asking Rishi Sunak what more he's going to do for the self-employed, but I want to know who's going to pay the money back and when. Finally this. Estimates of how many may die have swung between 500,000 and 5,000. Assuming we end up much closer to the latter, the experts will insist, and perhaps rightly, that it's because we took their advice on self-isolation, etc. But good scientists know the work of Sir Karl Popper, whose contribution to the philosophy of science was that no scientific hypothesis deserves the name unless capable of being falsified. So what level of fatalities, or what contrary evidence from countries that decided not to wreck their economies, would count as falsifying the assertion that it was the British lockdown that saved us? I simply ask. In due course, a science of medicine worthy of the name should be able to answer.
That was Matthew Paris. Now Lionel Shriver, whose novel The Mandibles rather predicted lockdown in a depressingly accurate way.
We're Anything But Safe by Lionel Shriver. Comically, Chinese Communist Party officials have speculated that COVID-19 was planted by the U.S. Army. Yet a respectable conspiracy theorist would deduce that a virus sending the rest of the world into an hysterical, wholesale economic shutdown has "Made in China" written all over it. After all, China didn't flatline its entire economy to contain the contagion. At the end of this debacle, then, China could rule the world, although it won't have many solvent customers left to buy its products. The only other countries calling the shots in future could be South Korea, Japan, and Sweden, having thus far resisted the stampede to lockdown. In my 1994 novel Game Control, a rogue demographer named Calvin Piper attempts to design a virus that will kill 2 billion people overnight, thereby arresting runaway population growth. I don't imagine my friend Calvin would think much of COVID-19. In his quest for a seriously nasty bug, I bet he'd pour a vial of the new coronavirus right down the sink. For as fatalities are broadcast even for Italy and Spain, I shout at the TV, "These numbers are ridiculously low." If a headline ran tomorrow, British deaths in 2020 to reach 600,000, we could expect widespread popular anxiety. Likewise, the forecast global deaths to exceed 58 million by year's end could drive governments to yet more draconian measures to defeat this plague. But 600,000 Britons did die last year, and so did more than 58 million people worldwide. We're unaware of it, but scads of people are dying around us all the time. Hate to break it to you, but we're mortal. We've been through alarmist projections of viral mortality before, and I don't mean just SARS or MERS, but HIV. Researching game control in 1990, I tracked down all 7 studies then available that modeled the impact of AIDS on population growth in Africa, where the epidemic was exploding. 4, all authored by epidemiologists, predicted that HIV would devastate African populations, whose growth would plunge to the negative. 3, authored by demographers, predicted that HIV would have a negligible effect on the continent's population, whose numbers would continue to soar. 30 years later, guess who was right? We live in factional times, so scientists and commentators are dividing into COVID camps, though allying with the smaller skeptics crowd can be dangerous. Some contrarians are getting death threats. Yet even the establishment Imperial College London has reduced its projections of COVID-19's UK mortality from 250,000 to under 20,000, roughly the same as annual deaths from seasonal flu. No one knows yet for sure, but evidence abounds that the lethality of this virus may be in line with flu's 1%, and possibly as low as 0.1%. The disease overwhelmingly fells the elderly with often multiple comorbidities. I don't mean old people don't matter, but absent this pandemic, a large portion of this ailing cohort would have been sadly slain by other illnesses in short order. As Dr. John Lee noted in The Spectator last week, too, fatality figures fail to distinguish dying from COVID and merely dying with it. Prey to simplistic sentimentality, politicians loath to land on the wrong side of the bogus money versus people debate could keep economies in the dead zone for months on end, through the summer, or even until the mass dissemination of that mythical vaccine in, say, 2022. Unremitting, better safe than sorry policies could transform life as we know it for years to come, and not in an improving direction. We're anything but safe right now. And the longer these lockdowns continue, the more imperiled we and our descendants become. We're flirting not merely with recession, we should be so lucky, but with a potentially self-sustaining depression, with all the social services decay, cultural malaise, personal desperation, and generational aimlessness that would entail. Forgive my further self-promotion to follow, but my latest novel is released in early May, and we might as well bury those hardbacks in my back garden. Of course, in converting 2 years' work to compost, I have company. Or companies, I should say. Many of which will go to the wall after proprietors sank not a mere 2 years, but sometimes their whole lives into these labors of love. My 2016 near-future novel, The Mandibles, portrays the United States in economic freefall. Russia, China, and friends contrive a currency to rival the dollar. In retaliation, the American president defaults on the eye-popping national debt. Naturally, the markets tank. No one lends money to deadbeats, so the U.S. government is denied access to borrowing. The Fed runs the printing press overtime. Inflation soars. First, supermarket shelves are bare. Clairvoyance, the first commodity to disappear, is toilet roll. And police are positioned in every aisle. Then, the shelves are full. But no one can afford to buy a $300 cabbage. D.C. nationalizes gold, sending the army banging on doors, searching for wedding rings. Meanwhile, more people are unemployed than in work, muggings are rife, and my characters are cast from their house at gunpoint. Indeed, this pro-gun control author had no choice but to secure her beguiling 16-year-old protagonist a revolver. Far-fetched? Public borrowing is set to skyrocket. Central banks will be tempted by the ugly shortcut of moderating sovereign debt through money printing, hello inflation, as well as confiscatory tax rates, because a prolonged shutdown could eviscerate the tax base. While UK firms self-isolate, many of their customers will turn to China. The deserters won't likely come back. And a broke society is a violent society. Look at the unrest already arising in Italy. You think not being able to go to the gym now is the bad part? No. How about what gym? How about why would I pay for a gym when I can't afford a liter of milk? Or sod the gym. I'll not go anywhere only to get knifed in the street. Never in the history of the world have most major economies simultaneously closed shop for months on end. I've rarely been this shaken, and not because I'm afraid of getting sick.
That was Lionel Shriver. Next is Isabel Hardman. I thought of her last week when I saw hens on sale in near a local supermarket. Isabel used to keep hens, and I thought you might like to write some words of advice to anybody tempted to stockpile them now.
Notes on Hens by Isabel Hardman. Is there nothing people won't panic buy during this crisis? Having stripped shelves of food and toilet roll, shoppers are now turning to chickens. Coop company Omelet reports a 66% rise in sales, and breeders have sold out of pullets. The British Hen Welfare Trust, which rehomes caged hens, has stopped taking new customers out of fear that the people bidding for their birds were either planning to eat them or didn't really know how to look after them. Keeping chickens does seem like a really good way of avoiding going to the shops. A good layer will give you an egg almost every day at this time of year, and having a flock in your back garden will mean you'll never run out. Your breakfasts will use eggs still warm from the hen's bottom, so fresh they poach beautifully. The yolks of happy, healthy hens are a rich gold that's nearly impossible to find in the supermarkets. I had my own four hens for a few years, and I miss them terribly, to the extent that they often flutter through my dreams. I would watch for hours as they scratched around looking for worms and worked their way around their complex social order. Hens aren't the brightest of birds, but they learn to associate certain objects with good news. Whenever I appeared carrying a green plastic bowl, they knew I was bringing porridge and would charge towards me. Once they had the bowl, there was little restraint. The birds would often dunk their entire heads in the food, emerging with gloopy oatmeal on their bright red combs. The loveliest spectacle was when the hens took a dust bath. This ritual keeps their feathers clean and free of parasites. They would scratch and peck out a hollow in the ground, and then settle their fluffy bodies into it and kick the dirt over themselves. They often took these spa breaks in pairs, lying contentedly by one another and bathing with a huffle-huffle thud of feathers and claws working the soil into their plumage. Seeing them this happy made it impossible for me to buy eggs from caged hens, or indeed those kept in barns, which is a misleading term for a massive shed full of thousands of birds wading around in their own faeces. Yet I won't be rushing to stock my garden with hens again. They need more space than the runs supply with most commercial coops. These are really just holding pens. And that means you need to surrender a large section of your garden, or the whole thing, to destruction. They will eat anything green and dig up anything that's left. Your lawn will turn into a brown pockmarked moonscape. They are so overjoyed by first light that they make an infernal noise, even if you don't have a cockerel. And the worst thing was not the foxes sniffing around their secure run, but the rats who, attracted by their feed, started to burrow under the coop. Alongside those lovely hazy dreams of my birds, I also have regular nightmares about the squeal of rodents at dusk. Chicken keeping would be bliss during lockdown. You'd have all the time in the world to clean out the coop, entertain the birds, and make sure they were out of harm's way. But at some point our lives will return to normal. Then you might find that, much like the lifetime supply of toilet roll clogging up your house, panic buying poultry wasn't quite as smart as it seemed.
That was Isabel Hardman, and that's it for this week's audio montage. I've no idea what you call this podcast, but I'd love to know what you think of it. This is a format we're playing with. We always love to hear from you, especially in these isolated times. So please do email any thoughts to podcast@spectator.co.uk. Thanks for listening, thanks for subscribing, and thanks to Cindy Yu, our producer.